Okay, so let's start out by doing some quieting meditation. You know, which is basically focusing the mind on one object. You know, when we do contemplative meditation, you know, there are two kinds of meditation basically. There's we use different terms, but the one kind is the focused meditation. And usually we use the breath as the object. What's another object that we use for single pointed meditation? What are some other objects that might be useful?
Color.
Pardon?
Color.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, an image of the Buddha. That's a kind in the Tibetan tradition, particularly try to visualize a little Buddha, smaller, bright, heavy. You know, about 6 feet in front, at the level of your forehead, and you try to focus on that. You could focus on the breath, the rising in the Zen tradition, or very commonly in rising the belly is the place you focus your attention. It almost doesn't matter what you focus your attention on. One monk in the Thai tradition, he just focuses his attention on sitting on the cushion, the sensation. Another guy I met focuses on what he calls the ringing silence, which from a medical perspective is tinnitus. Or tinnitus, for those of you. Anyway, you know, that ringing in the ear. So nothing to bother him. Anyway, you can hear works for you. And bring your attention to that for the next few minutes. you'll notice that your mind has a tendency to wander off, either to something that happened earlier or something that's going to happen, but usually that's much more interesting than just being present. But this is the practice. This is the practice. Letting go of these thoughts of past and future and bringing the mind back to the present. Whatever that experience is, breathing, sensations, whatever you're focusing on. Right. We say the sole purpose of practicing Tantra, the ideal practitioner is, their purpose for practicing is sort of preempted by this sense of urgency, like, as the same urgency that you would have if your child were drowning, you know, in a pool. You know, you'd be kind of like, I've got to do something now. This is not the time to mess around. So it's that sense of urgency based on compassion and wisdom. Like, I must develop, you know, I must learn life-saving. I must do whatever I need to do to save my child's life. Similarly, you know, Bodhisattva, a great being who has this kind of motivation, you know, they think of all living beings as like their children. They have that sense of closeness. They've developed it. And they wish to stop the suffering as quickly as possible. They take personal responsibility for that, and they have a sense of urgency, like, how can I quickly, develop myself so that I can help others see their truth, see it for themselves, you know, not me, like, push my trip on them. They get to teach them the method so that they can discover their own reality and then develop their full potentials. Wouldn't it be great to be that kind of person? That kind of living, that kind of being. That kind of being is called an enlightened being or a Buddha. Even though these aspirations seem so hard to imagine, just grandiose, but the mind can be changed through gradual familiarization, can be transformed. So it's not impossible. As much as you're capable, try to align your motivation for listening, being here, whatever you do between now and the end of the class, end of the course, that your motivation is, I must achieve my full potential for love, compassion, wisdom, power, skillful means, all the sort of immaculate qualities of an enlightened being. I must develop those because I have some of them already. I don't have them fully developed, but I aspire to develop myself completely in order to be able to quickly liberate, serve all living beings, including your family, including your children, including your co-workers and the people in your community, this community. You know, we don't, a living being seems like some sort of, doesn't mean much, does it? But you make it real when you think about the people that you live with and that you love and care about, and the people that maybe you don't love and care about, but that you come into contact with. So let's do the prayers. We'll start out with refuge and bodhicitta, and then we'll go up to the top of the page and do the four immeasurables, and then we'll turn over and do seven limb prayer and short mandala offering. Go for refuge until I'm enlightened, to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. Go for refuge until I'm enlightened, to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened, to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. May all sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all sentient beings be inseparable from the happiness that is free from suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. Reverently and prostrate with my body, speech, and mind, I present clouds of every type of offering, actual and imagined. I declare all my negative actions accumulated since beginningless time and rejoice in the merit of all holy and ordinary beings. Please remain until the end of cyclic existence and turn the wheel of Dharma for living beings. I dedicate my own merits and those of all others to the great enlightenment. Okay, this is a mandala offering. This ground anointed with perfume, strewn with flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, four continents, the sun and the moon. I imagine this as a Buddha field and offer it. May all living beings enjoy this pure land. Idam Guru Ratna Mandala Kam Niryata Yame. So tonight, we could launch into some well, I want to go over a little bit of the homework, and then we'll do a meditation on inner heat, and then we'll do some more talking about the three principles of the path and stuff. Now, how many? I see some new faces here, I think, but I'm not sure. Anybody here new? First time? Oh my goodness! Bless your heart. Well, do you know much about Tantra? Are you familiar with this subject? Okay. Well, it'll be interesting, maybe or not. But it's I'll have to. Anyway, some of this will make sense, and some of it won't. So this meditation that. Well, we'll get to it in a minute. All right, so review the three principal aspects of the path to enlightenment as presented in the text, the foundation of all good qualities. We did that last time. You'll notice, did everybody get the handout? No? Yes? Raise your hand if you didn't get the handout. Okay. We have some here. Extra. How many? Oh, shit, he's got it back there. Okay, good. Yeah. Anyway, it's the three principal aspects of the path. So this is, I really love this text. I think it's worth, I got it off of Lamyashi Wisdom Archives, and it's a freebie, but it's just really nice, and it boils down what you really need to know. Why are the three principal aspects of the path so important to this whole class that we're discussing? Why is this so important? Some of you people who have been putting some thought into it. Besides Robbie. Well, we'll just sit here until you come up with an answer. Why are the three principal aspects of the path important? Hello? Anybody?
That's where you begin, though, isn't it? Starting with pronunciation.
Yeah. Yeah. Good.
Okay, so the three principal aspects of the path, that's really the beginning, especially would begin with genuine renunciation. I mean, unless
the other two.
Bodhicitta. And then emptiness.
Yeah. So that's where you begin. When you say begin, what do you mean by that?
Well, without renunciation, I guess there would be no motivation. I mean, if you were
right.
Not wanting to renounce the worldly concerns or wanting to be like, decide to live in the palace instead of go out and seek enlightenment, I mean, there would be no need for renunciation or
right.
desire for it. So I guess that's kind of the primary cause of it, right?
You're there. You're close. But, it's bigger than that. It's even bigger than that.
Well, I mean, bodhicitta would be to the desire to help others.
Yeah.
Be free from suffering.
All right. And that's important for Tantra because, and you have to take this on faith, unfortunately, but it's like, You can trust me and Lama Zopa and Lama Yeshe and other people, I think, on this one. that if you meditate on if you do tantric techniques, which are very powerful techniques, I'm not joking. This is not a joke. These techniques are really done correctly, can either turn you into a saint or into a demon, depending on your motivation. And so, really important that you start out with compassion as your principal motive. So important. Can't emphasize it enough. And Lama Yeshe says, all the meditations, you know, you think, well, you've got to have compassion to meditate on Tantra. Well, it just turns out that, you know, bodhicitta to meditate on Tantra. But it turns out that tantric meditation enhances your bodhicitta. It really works that way. Even though you don't think of it, all these tantric meditations are designed to grow and exponentially grow bodhicitta. So it's really important.
And so actually, that brought up one question. I'm still at a point where even developing calm abiding, being able to maybe even focus on an image of the Buddha, I mean, maybe a minute, depending on how I am.
Yeah.
I mean, but I mean, tantra's way beyond that.
No. Actually, it's much easier to develop single body concentration using tantric methods. It's said to be much faster. Everything's about speed here. Tantra, speed. You know, it's an advertisement. It really is about a bit of, and it sounds like, you know, promoting it, but it said that it's much quicker path for developing wisdom. The wisdom of emptiness and single pointed concentration is the tantric path. So, all right. So anyway, I've handed out the three principal aspects of the path, and we'll go over this. We'll read through it tonight briefly in a few minutes. But I just wanted to go over this homework quickly. Then the second part. Second says, we need to gain a clear picture. This is quoting Lama Yeshe. We need to gain as clear a picture as possible of the way we presently conceptualize ourselves, the self that we identify with, project, and emanate. All right, so we need to gain a clear picture, as clear a picture as possible, of the way we presently conceptualize ourselves. Anybody got any clues why that's important? I haven't really talked about that question specifically, but if you've been doing the reading and homework, you may have an idea. Anybody? Yeah.
Kind of the metaphor of a mirror. The mirror is not clean. You're not going to see a good reflection.
That isn't exactly what I had in mind when I wrote that question, but I understand. I hear what you're saying. Anybody else have any idea about that? There's a Tibetan term. It's called gakcha, G-A-G-C-H-A or something like that. Gakcha. I like that word, and it's translated as the object of refutation. Sort of like that, the object of refutation. Now, when you're meditating, when you're doing deity yoga or tantra, we really have to get in touch with the way we conceptualize ourselves, because that's our biggest limitation, isn't it? We have such a huge inferiority complex about what we can do and what we can't do, and our limitations are endless. I mean, it's just, you know, it goes on and on and on. And Lama Yeshe talks a lot about this in his book. I mean, it's, you know, he says we, and the essence of what I hear, he says, is we have this gigantic, spiritual inferiority complex. And as long as we think we're worth this piece of crap, we're going to show up that way. And if we think that we're, without being arrogant, but we identify with our Buddha nature, our really amazing inner qualities, hadn't been fully developed, but why shouldn't we identify with those? Why should we think of, you know, when you start talking about yourself, you start, well, I'm not this. I mean, we tend to be negative. Let's be honest about it. Most of the self-talk is not positive. It's negative. And psychologists will verify that in a New York second. It's very negative. Lama Yeshe says it's completely self-defeating. So what we have to do is come to terms with all of these conversations and stories we've made up about ourselves and who we are and the limiting beliefs that we have about ourselves and realize that it is not true. Not even a word of it is true. Well, let me say this. It is true, but it isn't true. It's true for you, but it's not the truth. It's not the truth. Hang on. Yeah, it's, you know, when you look at your ordinary sense of self, and I used an example last week of one of the quick ways to get at it, you know, this sense of I, we have a sense, think about this, we have a sense of a separate self. You ever heard that before? A separate self. Now, here's the way you get that. My body is sitting, and my mind is thinking, and I'm talking, right? But there seems to be somebody else here that owns the body and mind. That's real. An owner of the body and mind that's real, concrete. Existing, I mean, it's hardwired, you know, and actually it's not there. You know, my body's sitting, my mind is thinking. This I is only a nominal I. There is no real concrete owner of the body and mind that exists out here in space or in the body or in the mind. It's not there. So we have it really clear who we think we are, because that is exactly who the Buddha is saying doesn't exist. So we got to know who our own gacha. We got to really get a sense of who we are, and then we need to let go of that, because otherwise tantra doesn't work. You have to be able to let go of your sense of self, ordinary, limited. Dawn, can't do this, can't do that. All of that dissolves into emptiness, and through understanding how reality exists, right? That there's no I that exists that way. I am empty, void of that kind of I. I do exist, but only nominally. Mind and body together becomes a human being who functions. Name is Dawn. Whatever your name is, that's what you're not. You have nominal existence. That's it. That's it. Everything else is projected by ignorance. Ignorance projects a sense of a separate self, believes it, holds onto it very strongly, gets annoyed at anything that gets in its way, gets attached to anything that brings us eating even fleeting moments of feeling good. You know, got to have more of that. You know, that's the false I, and we need to really know that, because when we let go of that I, and we meditate then on the spaciousness of emptiness, being void of that mistaken sense of self, it's from that space of emptiness, of selflessness, that the deity can arise, that we can manifest as Tara, Chenrezig, you know, color chakra, whoever, whatever practice we're choosing to do, you know, motivated by, you know, compassionate wisdom, you know, within the space of emptiness, we become the deity. And then we identify not with our limited sense of self, but with our body made of light. Now I am Green Tara. I'm this beautiful 16-year-old woman whose body's made of light. She's gorgeous, and everything about her is perfect. Every atom of her existence exists for one purpose, and that's to free living beings of suffering and establish them in the highest happiness of enlightenment. And that's me now. And I am that. Not my ordinary I. Not the ego I. Not the false I. But this is our nominal I. We label I on the deity. I am Tara. Or I am Chinrezig. Whatever practice we're doing, it could be there's many, many practices. If we want to develop wisdom, Manjushri. If we want to develop power, it's Vajrapani. If we want to develop compassion, it's Chinrezig. If we want to develop compassionate actions, sort of the active compassion, it's Green Tara. If we want to have longevity, long life, it's White Tara. To remove the obstacles to our long life so that we can serve others. And on, there's many different tantric deities at different levels. So, that's the point. That's why it's really important for us to think about emptiness. So, when we talk about emptiness, it sounds like nothingness, doesn't it? But it's not that. If you think about emptiness in a real practical way, and one of the examples is like if we all went outside the room, you know, and then all of a sudden you could hear an elephant trumpeting in here. You know, somebody was playing an audio tape of an elephant trumpeting. But we didn't, and as we were walking out, you know, I would tell everybody, somebody brought in a small elephant in the back door, and so there's an elephant in there. Anyway, you'd hear all these sounds, and then you would all be convinced, because I hadn't lied to you yet, at least as far as you know, that there's an elephant in here. But then, and so you're convinced there's an elephant in here. There's an elephant in the room. It's a great example, isn't it? An elephant in the room. There's a false eye in the room. There's an eye that ignorance projects in the room, same as the elephant. But you come back in the room and you look everywhere and you don't see it. You look everywhere. The elephant that you believed in your heart of hearts that was in this room and sounded like it was in the room, you know, and you were sure it was in the room, but you look everywhere. You can't miss it. There's no elephant here, is it? So then you could say, well, what I believed was there is not there. The room is empty of elephant, right? You could say that. The room is void of elephant. That's all we're talking about. We are void of this mistaken way of existing that we think that we are somebody special, and we're not. We're just a mind and a body, changing moment to moment, going through space and time, won't last that long. That's all we are. And ignorance projects a false sense of I, believes it. And in Buddhism, the Buddha's big aha, his moment of enlightenment, was when he saw that separate sense of self was a fiction. It was not the truth. That he was empty of that self-centered, selfish I. So, that's pretty wild. Now, selflessness, now all the good stuff can come forward because the ego, selfish, self-centeredness, is the obstacle to compassion, the obstacle to freedom, to loving kindness, to letting go, to not clinging attachment, arrogance, pride, every delusion you can ever imagine. It's based on this one fundamental mistake called ignorance. This lack of wisdom, which is not lack of knowledge. It's a very active process, isn't it? It's a misknowledge. We project a false sense. Ignorance projects a false sense of I, and we believe it. Ignorance projects that you are real, that you exist independent of my mind labeling you. No. Everything comes from the mind. There's nothing out there that exists independent of the mind. That sense that out there phenomena existing independent of the mind, doesn't exist, never did. That is void too. That's empty. What I see here is a room full of people. But actually, all of you look to me like you're real. Like if I walked out, if I walked out of here, my perception of you is exactly how you are. It just is how it is. We're all, you all look at this gong, this little gong thing here, and you think that you see it the way everybody else sees it. You look at me and you think you see me the way everybody else sees me. We walk out of this room and we see other people and other circumstances, and we think the way we see the world is the truth. And it's not the truth. It's only our truth. It's only the way our mind projects reality. There is a reality that exists, but it's not that one. It's the reality that is void of the projection. If we could somehow clear away the projection of inherent existence, of existence out there in and of itself from its own side, if we could somehow peel away those layers of paint that we project onto things and see them as merely labeled by the mind, there is a base, but it's just labeled by the mind. The mind creates a reality. That's the point. That's why this is. And so when you start thinking about tantric deities and all this kind of stuff, you think, oh, that's just a fictional thing. Or if you can't meditate on emptiness, and we try to do tantra, and I used the example of this last time, I said it's like putting on a wetsuit. If we don't meditate on emptiness, we don't let go of our ordinary sense of self, well, then all we're doing is taking our self, our mistaken sense of self, our egocentric self, and then imagining that we are deity. And that is never going to work. It's not going to work. We have to dissolve ordinary sense of I into the space of emptiness, and then from there arises the deity. It's really kind of a crucial point. Yes.
This is the kind of thing that I think back when I was in my 20s, and it was a very difficult time emotionally. And I've grown, and now I know new things. And if I had known that then, it would have been easier. So sometimes now, when I think of the concepts you've been talking about, I think, well, wait 5 minutes. That will go away. You aren't that. You can be something else. In your next life, you may never be lonely. It doesn't matter. So I take things less seriously, and that helps.
Mm-hmm. And you think the understanding emptiness helps you to let go of
the importance of my current emotion, the importance of what is going on right now, because the person next to me has the same thing or something slightly different with the same urgency.
Right.
I'm just trying to say, I don't know if I'm being clear, but it helps me.
Okay. Well, our thoughts, and we're talking about, I'm talking about the false sense of I and that level of ignorance. And we're talking about the ignorance of self and this ignorance of phenomena, the way everything exists outside. But even thoughts and feelings seem so real. They seem to be, real, hardwired. That's who I am, And we, there's a great, I did some practice one time and it helped my mind a lot, actually, in Thailand. And we sat there, it was just in this one monastery, and the practice was to see everything as impermanent. I think it's what you're saying, Susie. And you don't identify with it. When you're thinking, you don't go, normally we go, I'm thinking negative thoughts, or I'm having pain in my knee, or I'm sad, or I'm tired, or I'm lonely, or I'm angry, or whatever. We label it. But and that's practice. You just sit there, and whatever you experience, it was good. It was like, you know, pain in my knee. I'd be going, pain. Just mentally labeling pain. 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 Just lightly, every so often label it. And thoughts would come into my mind and dominate my thinking. I go, thinking. Not I'm thinking, but thinking. Thinking. And it would change. Always changes. Sensations change. The thoughts change. But when in the middle of depression, it doesn't feel like it's going to change, does it? It feels so real. So permanent, solid, heavy, never going to change. And you know, it can really drive people to the point of self-destruction because those thoughts feel so real and heavy, and we feed them. Rather than having the correct view of reality, we have the wrong view, and it causes a lot of suffering. Yeah.
The thought of multiple lives helps also.
Okay.
I believe part of my problem when I was in my 20s was, this is my only life, you have to get going, this is whatever it is, and you're not getting what you want, and I can let go.
Yeah, this is true. This helps. Okay, any other questions before we move on about this point? We will revisit it, but let's see. Okay, so rather than before we do the inner heat meditation, I think this is a good time to do the three principal aspects of the path. Now, I ask you to read the foundation of all good qualities, and you can do that too. But this is another version of it, and of the same basic points. I think this one particularly I find helpful for meditation. You can find commentaries on it all over the place. Lots of books on this particular text. It's really cryptic, and I may stop a little bit along the way and say a few things. But as I said, you know, if you go to Dalai Lama's teachings or something like that, he might spend, you know, 3 days talking about the three principal aspects of the path in various shapes and forms before he'll give a tantric initiation or empowerment, because he wants to make sure that everybody is grounded in this information. Now, do you have to really, this is something that those of you who've been doing reading should be able to answer. Do you need to be like a really advanced, have years and years of experience with the three principal aspects of the path before you take a tantric empowerment? Because the initiation, you can't just pick up a book. You could, but you shouldn't. Like, for example, Kala Chakra Tantra, and say, I'm going to practice that. People have done this, by the way. Not a good idea to do a tantric practice without having an initiation, or there are different Tibetan words for it, Jainong, Wong, a great Wong, a great initiation, and it's basically a guided meditation with your guru, the person that you've decided you can entrust, you trust them, and a lot of people see the Dalai Lama as a guru, but they'll never meet him, right? So you don't necessarily have to meet the guru, but you have to have enough confidence in this person and you're willing to see them as a living Buddha now. That's important. So you take this initiation, but you don't take the initiation until you've gotten some degree of knowledge. How much do you need? I mean, how do you know when you're ready to take an initiation? Everybody wants to get enlightened fast, right? Everybody wants bliss and emptiness. Raise your hand. Everybody wants that. And they want it now, as quick as possible. And they'd like to help others as quick as possible too, right? Wouldn't you say? So what do you need to know to take an initiation? By the way, this is really the point of this class, was that you get enough information that you could decide. So, you may not know the answer to this right now. Anybody have any kind of hint? I don't know, brother. I don't know for you, okay? I think I will say a few things about it, though. You do need to know the three principal aspects of the path. And you have to have more, and you should, I think, have, and I'm, I don't, I cannot speak for, my teachers per se, because I can't say exactly what they'd say, but I don't think they would disagree with this. You have to, it's more than just you read this text and you go, okay, I understand the words. You actually have some feeling for it, and that you've put some time and effort into trying to understand what this means, renunciation, bodhicitta, and emptiness. It doesn't mean that you understand it perfectly, but it does mean that you have an intellectual understanding of it and some appreciation for it. And if you need to have faith in the tantric path, and you have to have faith in the tantric guru. It's not... you just don't jump into these practices without having some sense of faith, and then you're going to be committing to a daily practice when you do take an initiation, and you're going to be committing to some vows. So you got to be ready for that. Are you ready to take certain vows, like the Bodhisattva vows? You can study those. There are 18. Regular main ones and 46 secondary ones or something like that. You can study those before you take them. And they're pretty easy to understand. And you wouldn't have a hard time even aligning with them, because there's like do the right thing and don't do the wrong thing. And, there's even one vow that says you can break all the other vows if that's the compassionate thing to do, the compassionate wise thing to do. It's a little tricky, that one. But, anyway, you can study the Bodhisattva vows, but you cannot study the tantric vows, which have to do with yoga tantra and highest yoga tantra, the two more advanced levels of tantra. You can't study. You're not even supposed to look at them until you've taken the initiation. Kind of interesting. So you're getting into some pretty deep water here. You get a daily practice, vows, and most of the time you're committing at some point in your life to do a long retreat, to do a retreat on that deity. Now, if it's Green Tara, for example, you can do that retreat in a week. It's usually a number of mantras that you're doing and stuff like that. But you're committing to quite a bit. So, you got to be... But again, the point is, getting back to the three principal aspects of the path, is that you have some feeling or understanding. And those of you who have been doing Discovering Buddhism for the last almost 2 years, this is no big deal. This is something that you've been studying over and over and over again. And you have some feeling for it. And that's enough. That is really enough. Now, are you ready to take vows and commit to a daily practice and see the guru as the Buddha? I don't know. That's up. That's a personal decision. But again, the motivation for doing it, if your motive is I have to develop myself as quickly as possible so I can help others, that's the proper motive. So if the motivation is I want to look good, or I want to be cool, or I want to fit in, or everybody else is doing it, or that will get you nowhere. They might get you in trouble, but it won't get the results. Okay, so let's read this together. And on the back of this is your homework for the next couple of weeks, but you don't have to look at that now. So we'll and I may stop along the way, but again, and for some reason I couldn't go in and fix it, but they bolded certain stanzas And that doesn't mean that they're more important. It just means that they're bolded. Okay. Expressing homage. So Lama Zopa has gone through here and put a little caption, like expressing the homage. That's not in the original text, but it is. He said that's what that's about. So the first line is, I bow down to my perfect gurus. First, right out of the gates, we're talking about the gurus again. Why is that so important? Why is that so important? Why is it important? Some of you people who are, I guess it's just me. I'm the only one doing the homework. And I'm not even doing it very well. Well, there is a reason why the guru is important. The guru is important for, because they introduce us to this practice. If there's only one way to get enlightened in this lifetime, by the way, and that's to practice highest yoga tantra. The sutra tantra, the sutra path won't get you enlightened. Highest yoga tantra practice does get you enlightened. Why? Because it's only through highest yoga tantra practice that we can access this subtlest, most powerful, laser-like mind that can cut through delusion and see reality as it is. So we have to be able to access or to cultivate that mind, and it's only through highest yoga tantra techniques that we can do that. So, the guru introduces us to it's only through the door that the guru opens for us that gives us access to the whole Dharma in the beginning and to Tantra in particular. And here's like the most important teaching in all of Tantra. You will not get what I'm saying. So I mean, you just need to hear it and read it and hear it again and again and again and again and again. But this is like, this is like the most important thing. If you ever do a retreat or a practice or anything, you need to be able to see your mind, the deity's mind, and your guru's mind as indivisibly oneness. Your mind, the deity's mind, and your guru's mind as inseparably one. What in the world does that mean? Why is that important? Logically, why? I mean, I can tell you, I have a theory. I haven't read this yet, but I think it might be true. You know, I mean, I was raised Christian, and they talk about the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost, or something like that, isn't it? But anyway, I think in some ways. Like, I don't know if this is a good analogy, but it's one that comes to my mind. It's almost like if I were, from a Christian perspective, and maybe some of you are Christians and will go back to the Christian church and stuff like that, but it's like, it's very hard to make the leap from being me to God, right? But here's Jesus, this person who lived and walked on this planet, who like is God-like. So I think that's one of the attractions of Christianity, is it gives people a role model, a living being that's God-like. And in a sense, the deities that we meditate on are almost sort of like gods. We can't imagine ourselves as being perfect. But then we have our teacher, our guru, this living being that's like God-like or deity-like, We are seeing them as a perfect being now. All right? And so that helps our mind to bridge the gap, I think, for me, between my deluded state and my sense of really being a limited person with this and that fault and blah, 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 and the guru and the deity, seeing that we all are, you know, inseparably one. Our minds are all empty. You know, it's the same emptiness. It's not a different emptiness. You know, the guru, I'm imagining, has a fully developed wisdom and compassion, and the deity does. And if I'm doing the practice, I imagine that I have it too. So if I'm seeing myself as Green Tara, I'm thinking, okay, I have the same wisdom, compassion, power, skillful means, and so on, as the guru and the deity. I have it too. So this is really, really important to point that Lama Yeshe drives home again and again. You know, this inseparability of your mind, the deity's mind, and your guru's mind is inseparably one. I don't know exactly what that means, but I do have an idea. I think it's a huge help. I mean, I actually have some experience of that really helping me on occasion. You know, so it's a great thing to remember, because we can't relate to deities very well, but we can relate to a living being who has amazing qualities, you know? And it's really nice if your guru behaves himself, you know? You have a guru who's not a troublemaker, a scoundrel. There are some gurus that are really difficult, you know? They are so hard to... because their behavior is so off the wall, and you go, and maybe there are Buddhas just manifesting being a scoundrel, but it's a lot easier to have a guru who's like really holy, and you know their behavior is immaculate, and you know their motivation is pure. It's so much easier to relate to somebody like that as an enlightened being. Although I will say, enlightened beings can kick your butt, and will, when the time is right. If you ever have a guru, don't expect them to be nice to you all the time. Sometimes gurus do amazing things. You know, they might like hit you with a stick. They might pick you up and throw you out of the gompa. Why would they do that? Because the job of the guru is to help you see your mind, not to make you feel good. Help you see your mind wake up. So that might be tough. It might be called what they call tough love. All right? Sometimes they call it crazy wisdom. That's a very risky business, though. So you better pick your gurus carefully, because, you know, these people you're going to give them tremendous power. When you commit to seeing somebody as a Buddha, you can't take it back. Now you're in it for life. You can't take it back. You can't. But then that's another story. That's really not good. There are ways to extricate yourself from a guru. You know, if their behavior is too off the wall for you, there are ways to sort of move away. But never judge your guru as anything other than a Buddha. But you can say, that's a Buddha, and I just can't handle that Buddha's behavior right now. I'm not ready for that. Maybe later on I'll be stronger, but I'm just going to move away and go find another Buddha, a guru, like that. So that's one of the, I'm getting a little ahead of myself, but you get the point. I bow down to my perfect guru. So you're really, really important. It's, everything starts with the teacher, with the gurus. And they're more than just, you know, somebody sitting up here like me. A guru is somebody with, I think, like heavy with good qualities is another term for a guru. All right. Now, Lama Zopa is helping us along here. He says, the promise to compose. So this is what this next line is. Let's read this together. The essential meaning of the victorious one's teaching, the path praised by all the holy victors and their children, the gateway of the fortunate one's desiring liberation. This I shall try to explain as much as I can. So this is Lama Tsongkhapa promising to compose this text. Then he's going to persuade us to listen. Those who are not attached to the pleasures of circling, who strive to make freedom and endowments meaningful, who entrust themselves to the path pleasing the victorious ones, you fortunate ones, listen with a calm mind. So freedom and endowments, I'm coming back to that here again. I'm coming back to that in a couple of stanzas. All right, the next one, the purpose of generating renunciation, the first of the three principal aspects. Without the complete intention definitely to be free from circling, there is no way to pacify attachment seeking pleasurable effects in the ocean of circling. Also, by craving for cyclic existence, embodied beings are continuously bound. Therefore, at the very beginning, seek renunciation. So this is getting to the point that you were making earlier. Without the complete intention to be free from circling. Circling is samsara. It's this cycle of uncontrolled causation that we've been caught in since beginningless time, you know, where we take the past. We can see this so clear in our lives. It is ridiculous. Most of us take the past, throw it in front of us, and walk right back in and do that same thing over and over and over again. That's called samsara. Okay, that's just, we're not free of circling. Without the complete intention to be free of circling, there's no way to pacify attachments seeking the pleasures of the ocean of circling, samsara, ordinary, you know, sensual pleasures. That's what we're hooked on. We're, as one great Buddhist saint in Thailand says, Ajahn Buddhadasa says, we are addicted to deliciousness. I couldn't refute it. We're addicted to deliciousness, aren't we? And we hate anything that's not delicious or the opposite of delicious, which is offensive. So we got a problem because everything's not delicious. We're gonna have trouble. So they said there's no way to stop our suffering unless we can pacify this attachment, seeking the pleasurable effects of the ocean of circling. All right. Now the next one, how to generate renunciation. So the next two lines are how to do that. This is really cool because he's told this. There are four meditations in here that you can do. The first one is freedom and endowments are difficult to find, and life has no time to spare. By gaining familiarity with this, attraction to the appearances of this life is reversed. So freedom and endowments. Those are the 8 freedoms and 10 endowments that most of you have memorized by now. You know, but it basically means, look, this is an amazing life. We not only are born human, we not only have our faculties, not only, you know, are we, you know, none of us are in prison or, you know, completely nuts, maybe just a little nuts, but not completely nuts. You know, we have a healthy human body. We live in a place and a time where the Dharma exists, teachers exist that are exponents of the Dharma, that are perfect examples of the Dharma. We have some interest in it, and we found a Dharma center out here in the middle of nowhere, this Dharma desert called Wake County. I'm just teasing. You know, we found the Kadampa Center. How wonderful. So it's like, wow, so freedom and endowment, so difficult to find. And life has no time to spare. Life is so short. Death is definite. The time of death is indefinite. The only thing that's going to help you at the time of death, the only currency you can spend on your deathbed are your spiritual realizations. Are you calm? Are you happy? Are you at peace? Have you lived a life of and full of regrets? Are you at peace with yourself? And have you made a contribution? Have you lived the good life? Or have you been like a total disaster and a suck to the universe? You know, instead of being a contribution, you've been like a black hole. You know, and only you know that. So life is so short. Look, so here we are. Freedom and endowments, so precious. And it's so short. So precious, so short. So precious, so short. Attraction to the appearances of this life should be reversed. If we do this meditation well, then we're not so hooked up in trying to find another sensory fix. Right? Because life is precious because we can use it to get enlightened. And it's short because it is short. So what are you going to do with it? You're going to waste it? Going in, you know, going to France one more time? Well, I'm telling you, France is a pretty nice place, come to think of it. There's nothing wrong with going to France. There's nothing wrong with sensory pleasures. There's nothing wrong with anything that makes us feel good. What's the problem with it? What did Lama Yeshe say? Lama Yeshe said, we should have the highest happiness. We should have the most bliss. We should have it all. But right now, most of our happiness and bliss just creates more suffering for us, doesn't it? It's like drinking salt water. We just want more. It just causes more dissatisfaction. Because we're deluded. All worldlings are deluded. First noble truth. So, nothing wrong with France. It's what we think is in France that gets us in trouble. Nothing wrong with a good meal. It's what we think the good meal is going to do for us. Or that beautiful sunset. Or that great, you know, sexual experience that somehow is going to happen one day. You know, it just creates, you know, it creates, you know, a dissatisfied mind that wants more and more, never satisfied. Never satisfied with anything. We are never satisfied with anything. I can say that from my, now I'm just speaking from personal experience here, but but I got a feeling a lot of us are that way. We just are not satisfied. And Lama Zopa says, of all the suffering and samsara, that's the worst. Like, that's worse than a broken leg. That's worse than being depressed. That's worse than dying, really. Because it's like low-level radiation. We can never find any peace. So that dissatisfied mind is like, you know, huge. And that's what we're renouncing. We're not renouncing pleasurable experiences. We're renouncing the attachment to pleasurable experiences. You know? We're renouncing the dissatisfied mind. You know, that why can't we enjoy something and be satisfied with it? Because we cling. Because we think it's something more than it is, and we cling to it, and we have greater expectations than it could ever deliver, and we're always dissatisfied, and that's ignorance. So we can enjoy, Lama Yeshe says, enjoy everything, but enjoy it with wisdom, with compassion, not with a, you know, a clingy, sticky mind, okay? So that's the first meditation. And it says, by thinking, let's do, read this together, by thinking over and over again that actions and their effects are unbetraying, and repeatedly contemplating the miseries of cyclic existence, attraction to the appearances of future lives is reversed. Now, most of us don't even believe in a future life, but those of you who do, you know, and there are people that believe in a future life, well, they go, well, you know, I've done a decent job, been a nice enough person in this life. If there's a future life, you know, I'll be okay, I guess. But, you know, and so that's kind of an attraction to future lives. And it's wrong. You know, the two points are that what? First is karma. Yeah, karma's definite. And look at your life. Most of the stuff we've done is negative. Most of the stuff we've done. Here's how I know this. Any action motivated by attachment. Wait a minute. Hold on. Let me say it another way. Any action motivated by non-hatred, non-ignorance, or non-attachment, any action motivated by that always leads to happiness. Always, always, always. Any action motivated by greed, hatred, or ignorance always leads to suffering. Always, always leads to suffering. Well, since they're future lives and we never know what the action we did today is going to lead to, because it might ripen in 100,000 lifetimes from now. But the way we can know is our motive in the moment. Was our motive selfish or was our motive compassion? Was our motive, you know, was it to help others or was it to sort of pump ourselves up. You know, so the motivation is crucial for karma, and so karma is really, really important. We have to have what Lama's Geshe Gelug calls conviction faith in karma. If this is so important to really have faith that what goes around comes around, that what you put out comes back to you, that karmic boomerang, that every moment of your life, we're planting seeds that are going to come back to us as happiness or suffering. We shape our future by the choices we make now. We're saying the same thing, aren't we? Over and over in lots of different ways. We're shaping our future, which is right now, right? Because we're literally being reborn every second, aren't we? Kinda. In a sense, we're shaping our future tomorrow, next week, next month, next year by the choices we make now. Really important to see that our karma is literally shaping our lives. It's because things are empty, our karma ripens. I talked about this in another class. Our karma is constantly ripening, causing us to have an experience right now. What you're seeing, how you see yourself, how your self-image, good, bad, pleasant, unpleasant, how you're experiencing this class, how you're experiencing your life outside this, everything is the fruit of your former actions. Bam, popping in karmic, billions of karmic seeds ripening constantly. That's what creates our life. That's what creates our life, are the seeds that were planted in the past by who knows who. Doesn't matter. It was this mental continuum in a former lifetime, many, 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 many billions of former lifetimes. Who cares? But it's this mental continuum now that's ripening, creating the experience of me having experience of me now. And tomorrow will be the fruition of the choices I make now. So it's the sum of all of my former actions are creating my experience of nowness. Really have to get that what goes around comes around. So that's what he's saying. And the actions and their effects are unbetraying and repeatedly contemplating the miseries of cyclic existence. So again, it's getting back to the whole thing of suffering. As long as we think that this world is a pleasure palace, and by the way, it is, if you got the right kind of mind. But with the kind of minds we have, no way. Impossible. You know? It's not going to happen because we're deluded. We're ignorant. We're self-centered. We think we're the most important one in the world. There's no pleasure. You know, a Buddha or an Arhat, they're so blissed out, they can't stand it. This world is a pleasure palace to them because they have wisdom and they have compassion and they don't suffer. They have developed their minds. But with ordinary minds like we have, no way. You know, we are going to suffer again and again and again in future lives. So why? So he's saying karma is definite and the future looks like the past. If you've suffered up until now, you will suffer again in the future. You know, it will come back to you. So there's no, you know, so we shouldn't be attached to some future life's happiness. The point is, what's the point? Do it now. Do it now. Practice now. Purify your mind now. Develop your qualities now while you got a shot at it. Because you never know what the future life's going to bring. Chances are it's going to bring more suffering. This is the Buddha's point. You know, the past was suffering. We've been in many suffering situations. And what do you got to look for in this life? Look for it. This is really great that you're here tonight. You can hear this. You'll probably never come back, but that's okay. You know, really, Buddhism is like an invitation. Check it out. If it works for you, fine. If it doesn't, you know, it's not for everybody. It really is okay to come and check it out. And if you find something that's useful, you put it into practice. And then if you don't, you don't. But the Buddha said that, you know, we, all worldlings are deranged, you know, and what kind of minds we have, the future is not going to go well for us unless we put some emphasis in transforming ourselves while we're alive. And the belief is in Buddhism is that we have this ginormous potential, but we don't access it because we don't know how to. We didn't know there was a path to enlightenment. We didn't know that there were methods that have been, you know, for 2,500 years have been practiced and perfected, and actually there are people that live like this now. We didn't know that, but now we do. So the point is, practice now. Put your emphasis in practicing now. All right, let's read the next one. So we'll go through these next one pretty quick. The definition of having generated renunciation. So you want to know, I've been doing these meditations, these, you know, different meditations. How do I know if I've done it? When, we'll say this, we'll do this together. When by having trained in that way, there's no arising even for a second of attractions to the perfections of cyclic existence, and all day and night the intention seeking liberation arises, then the thought of renunciation has been generated. So that's what renunciation is. It's kind of like, they say it's sort of like when your hair is on fire, but it's that sense of urgency that you want to put the fire out. You're just so tired of it. You know, you don't want to suffer anymore. You're just, I'm done. I am done. I don't want it. I don't want any more of this. I want out of here. And again, this implies that there is the potential to be liberated from suffering. Again, that's the third noble truth, isn't it? The truth of the cessation of suffering. So you really have to have, I think you have to have some experience in your meditation practice where you, and in your daily Dharma practice where you've been suffering and you bring the Dharma to the moment and you see yourself not suffering or suffering less, and somehow you let go of your anger or your resentment or your pride, and you can breathe in a sigh of relief and you go, wow, that really worked. And then you have some faith, you know? You know, it's like that. You have to see that this works before you can have any faith that it's possible to become liberated. I think that's true. All right, now the next one. The mind of enlightenment is bodhicitta. Even if renunciation has been developed, let's read this together, if it is not possessed by the mind of enlightenment, it does not become the cause for the perfect bliss of unsurpassed enlightenment. Therefore, the wise generate the supreme mind of enlightenment. That's pretty clear. All right, now he's saying this is how we do it, and these are some contemplations, some sort of contemplative meditations that could be done. Swept away by the current of the four powerful rivers, tied by the tight bonds of karma so hard to undo, caught in the iron net of self-grasping, completely enveloped in the total darkness of ignorance. He's talking about us. Ooh, doesn't sound too good, does it? Endlessly reborn in cyclic existence. That's samsaric rebirth from beginningless time until now. We've been reborn in samsara. Ceaselessly tormented by the three sufferings. Sufferings of suffering, change, and pervasive suffering, thinking that all mothers are in such a condition, generate the supreme mind of enlightenment. So all mothers have to do with seeing all sentient beings as having been like family. In the countless rebirths, it's possible that all beings have been our mothers, which is the point. All right, the definition of having generated the mind of enlightenment. In short, if like the mother whose cherished son has fallen into a pit of fire and who experiences even 1 second of his suffering as an unbearable eternity, your reflection on the suffering of all mother sentient beings has made it impossible for you to bear this suffering for even 1 second, and the wish seeking enlightenment for their sake arises without effort, then you have realized the supreme precious mind of enlightenment. Well, that's bodhicitta. That's like, you know, those of you, and even those of you who have, anybody who has family or people that they dearly love, you know, if they're in an intensive care unit or they're suffering right now, I don't care where you are. You could be at Kadampa Center or work, but you're thinking about them, aren't you? Constantly, day and night. Well, this is that kind of mind that constantly, day and night, wishes to be enlightened in order to stop the suffering of living beings. And it is pervasive. And when you have that in your mind, day and night, 24/7, you're a bodhisattva. And you're on your way out. You're on your way out of suffering. Okay, now this particular sadhu, you see how it says 8a? This is not in the original text. Rama Zopa extracted it from Prabhaka Rinpoche's text. So, but it explains what Bodhicitta is like, so he put it in there, and I think it's very helpful that he did that. All right, now the reason to meditate on right view. Right view has to do with reality or truth. Without the wisdom realizing ultimate reality, even though you've generated renunciation in the mind of enlightenment, you cannot cut the root cause of circling. Therefore, attempt the method of realizing dependent arising. So I'll tell you a quick story. I may have said this before. I had an opportunity to speak to Lama Zopa many years ago, and I was in his room, and I was getting ready to come home. I'd been gone for a long time, I was in Nepal at the time, and I'd been gone, and I was just talking to him, and he said, he looked at it, just off the wall, he said, you know, if you don't develop realization of emptiness, you can't stop your suffering. And I went, you know, I was like, wow, I didn't really want to hear that. And then he went on, he went into it in quite a bit of detail. But this is the point, you know, even if you have renunciation, even if you have compassion, it's not enough. You've got to have, in Buddhism we talk about the two wings of the bird, right? There's the wing of method and the wing of wisdom, right? And method has to do with more with compassion, and wisdom has to do with seeing reality as it is, okay? And you got to have both. You can't just be smart. You got to be kind. And you can't just be kind. You got to be smart, right? So you have to have both. So this is what he's saying. You've got to have both wisdom and compassion. And therefore, he's saying, attempt the method of realizing dependent arising. I'm not going to say much about it. Well, I will say this. Dependent arising, there's three things that you need to know. And it proves why there's not an elephant in this room. And it proves where there's not an I in the, you know how I said, the body's sitting and the mind is thinking. Where's the I? That I that we think of is me, that is really, really me, is a fiction. It's a made up I. Okay. But there is an I that exists, and it exists independence upon what? Causes and conditions. We do exist in dependence upon causes and conditions. That's not profound, is it? That's pretty obvious. Sperm, egg, all kinds of experiences, food, people that we meet, you know, all the experiences that we've had in our life. All of those are causes and conditions. So we do exist in dependence upon causes and conditions. We do exist, and again, we do exist in dependence upon parts. Like we're made up of all kinds of billions of atoms. All these atoms have come together, and we exist in dependence upon parts. That is really important to get, because the other things we're talking about are conceptual. This is something you can see. You got hair, you got an arm, you got fingers and atoms. You know, you got body parts. You got liver and spleen and kidneys and all this kind, everything that you are made up of parts. But this doesn't seem profound, but you exist in dependence upon parts. And you exist, the most profound thing is that you exist in the, I and you, we all exist in dependence upon a mind that labels. We are merely label I. The I that exists is a mere label. Okay? There's no I other than the label I. This falsely projected, hallucinated, real, I'm the center of the universe, that's a fiction. Okay? The I that exists, and that I, and you gotta get, because this is more than a semantics game, okay? That I that we think is so real is gotcha. It's the object of refutation. It's that I seems to exist independently. Okay? Independently. Not dependently. Independently. So you gotta hear the difference. If it existed independently, then it couldn't depend on anything, could it? It couldn't depend on parts, couldn't depend on causes and conditions. It couldn't depend on parts, and it couldn't even depend on a consciousness that designates it, that labels it. So, it's impossible. It's like this is the proof that there's no elephant in the room. There's no I that exists that way. There's no independently self-existent I. And so we have to get it, that we are void, we're empty of that I. This room is empty of elephant. That I, that elephant that we believe so strongly in, that existed, when we came and looked for it, we couldn't find it. When we come and try to find an independently existing I, all we find is an I that exists in dependence upon causes and conditions, parts, and a consciousness that labels it. That's who we are, and that's all we are. We're not this self-existent center of the universe, most important one, blah, 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 that we make up. We're not that. We're empty of that. What a relief. What a relief. All that stuff you made up about yourself is not true. It's just stuff you made up about yourself. Now, it's true for you. If you believe it, it's true for you. But in reality, it's not true. It's a fiction. And you have to get, this is really important. So, dependent arising is like the Buddhist slogan. It's like the proof that things are empty. Okay? So, again, you don't have to believe this. This is stuff, though, that you can actually understand and prove for yourself with a little bit of thought. A lot of thought. But, we'll read on. So, showing the right view. One who sees the cause and effect of all phenomena of both cyclic existence and the state beyond sorrow as forever unbetraying, and for whom any object trusted in by the grasping mind has completely disappeared, has at that time entered the path pleasing the Buddhas. So here's what he's saying. He's saying when you are in your meditation and you get a sense of gaccha, of that false sense of I that you believe so strongly in, and then you use the analysis called, you know, of dependent arising, and you look for that self-existent, independently existent I, and you can't find it because it exists dependent upon its causes and conditions and parts and the consciousness that designates it. You can't find an I that exists that way. When you look for it and you can't find it, what appears to your mind is spaciousness. And what your mind is apprehending in at that moment of spaciousness is the emptiness or the voidness of true, inherent, independent existence. So two things are coming together at one moment. You know, there's a total dissolution of this false, fictional way of seeing things. It's gone. The way you see yourself has completely disappeared, and now you're seeing yourself as completely empty of that false sense of self. All right? That's what this stanza is talking about. And for whom any object trusted in by the grasping mind, that's that false sense of self, has completely disappeared, has at that time entered the path pleasing the Buddhas. So, yay. Now we got a sense of emptiness. All right, next one. If the appearance of dependent relation, which is unbetraying, is accepted separately from emptiness, and as long as they are seen as separate, then one has not realized the Buddha's intent. I'm not going to explain that. But that's worth, that's important. Because these two realizations, I'll say this much. This is quoting Jeffrey Hopkins. When you understand dependent arising, how things arise, those three points I just made, and you understand the emptiness of inherent existence, you see more, yogis see more and more how these things are the same. They're the same thing, all in one package. They're inseparably one. That the emptiness of inherent existence proves that things are the dependent arising proves that things are empty of inherent existence. And the fact that things are empty of inherent existence is because they are dependent arising. And so you see, they complement one another. And so, but he's saying that when you see them as separate, that's not the Buddha's intent. A Buddha sees these things as happening simultaneously. a little bit hard to wrap your mind around this, but we'll, anyway. If these two realizations are happening simultaneously without alternation, and for merely seeing dependent relation as completely unbetraying, the definite ascertainment comes that completely destroys the way all objects are apprehended as truly existent. At that time, the analysis of the ultimate view is complete. So this is really, you know, this is an analytical process where you're using your wisdom, your intelligence, to see that we have made a lot of assumptions about reality that aren't true. Next one. Further, appearance eliminates the extreme of existence, and emptiness eliminates the extreme of non-existence. If you realize how emptiness manifests in the manner of cause and effect, then you are not captivated by wrong notions holding extreme views. And I'll just say that. This sounds a little crazy. And again, if you read through some of the commentaries, they're nice commentaries on this practice that aren't too long. And then they're long ones too. But, you know, I think that third line, if you realize that emptiness manifests in a manner of cause and effect, it's kind of interesting that things, if, you know, here's a poor man's understanding of emptiness. It's like there's nothing out there. It's as if you can't find anything that exists independent of your mind. And we think it does, don't we? But there's nothing out there that's truly findable, that exists in and of itself, independent of my mind projecting it. You see that? There's nothing out there that exists independent of my mind. Our mind is creating our reality. Now, there's a basis that my mind labels it, but it doesn't exist independently of my mind. So, here's the point that I'm trying to make. For us beginners, this is a practical point. It's as if we're walking into a movie theater and there's a big screen and there's nothing on it. Okay? And the projector turns on and all of a sudden, it's your life. And that projector is cause and effect, karma, projecting your life. Everything arises or comes into existence independent upon causes and conditions. So that's why ethics is so important. That's why it's so important to understand karma, because our life is literally, we're literally being forced by our karma because things are empty, because there is no out there existence independent of my mind. My mind is literally being, we're forced to see ourselves as a certain way. You know, we're forced to see ourselves as a man or a woman. And, you know, if I hit your third molar, the nerve on your third molar with a dental drill, you can't say that feels good. You know, you're going to hurt. You're forced by your karma to see that as painful. So our karma, because of a cause and effect, and because things are empty, our whole life is unfolding. It's an unfolding of our karma. So it's really, really important to see how these, you know, how these work together. You cannot say that there's nothing out there and that I can do anything I want to. It's not like that. No, karma is understanding karma is an integral part of understanding emptiness. Integral part of understanding emptiness. There are some people that go to the extreme of saying, well, there's nothing. You know, everything is empty. You can't, it's unfindable. Therefore, nothing exists. Therefore, it doesn't matter what I do. I'll do anything I want. And that is a big mistake. That's called nihilism. And that's called the extreme of nihilism. Then there's the other extreme where you think everything is exists the way it appears. And that's called the extreme of eternalism. It's just another problem. It creates more problems. But nihilism creates even more problems. So we don't want to do that. We don't want to throw out the baby with the bathwater here. Karma is still a crucial part of the understanding of emptiness. Because, again, things exist independent upon causes and conditions, right? Just like we said. All right. So, than the last stanza. In this way, you realize exactly the vital points of the three principal aspects of the path, resort to seeking solitude, generate the power of effort, and quickly accomplish your final goal, my child. So nothing in here about Tantra, by the way. But, he's, you know, it's implicit in here. Because Lama Tsongkhapa was a Tantric master. And he knows that that's how you get enlightened. But you have to have these principal aspects of the path, and Tantra really makes us stronger in understanding these points. So it's an important point. So it's 7:42. We're a little bit over time. I'm just kidding. I got carried away here. But I think it was important to get through this text because this is the... And I've talked about Tantra, and we'll get into it in more detail. In fact, we'll do a practice. It's in the readings. Lama Zopa did one. John Landau did. If those of you who've gone online, John Landau did two compassion meditations. I was going to do them tonight, but we didn't do them. But they were based on Chinrezig practice and the mantra Om Mani Padme Hum. Chinrezig, where's Chinrezig? Thousand Arm. Well, there's a forum Chinrezig too, but I don't see it. I don't think it's here. But there's a Thousand Arm Chinrezig there and there. But anyway, Chinrezig is the Buddha of compassion. But I want us to do the one on Green Tara. There's one in the readings, Lama Zopa, one of the texts. And so if you get a chance, try to do the front visualization of Green Tara. And do the mantra and stuff like that. And then we'll do that. I promise we'll do some meditation. Had to get to this point, though, to get this foundation stuff in here. And your homework is on the back. Read Tara the Liberator. Perfect. So you'll be ready to go. And now we'll do a dedication, some dedication verses, and wrap it up. Okay, the pink sheet at the top. May all beings everywhere, plagued by sufferings of body and mind, obtain an ocean of happiness and joy by virtue of my merits. May no living creature suffer, commit evil, or ever fall ill. May no one be afraid or belittled with a mind weighed down by depression. May the blind see forms and the deaf hear sounds. May those whose bodies are worn with toil be restored on finding repose. May the naked find clothing, the hungry find food. May the thirsty find water and delicious drinks. May the poor find wealth, those weak with sorrow find joy. May the forlorn find hope, constant happiness, and prosperity. May there be timely rains and bountiful harvests, and may all medicines be effective and wholesome prayers bear fruit. May all who are quick, sick, and ill quickly be freed from their ailments. Whatever diseases there are in the world, may they never occur again. May the frightened cease to be afraid and those bound be freed. May the powerless find power and may people think of benefiting each other. For as long as space remains, for as long as sentient beings remain, until then, may I too remain to dispel the miseries of the world. Okay. So thank you for your attention. This is, by the way, this subject is just, I think it's very cool that you have got, that you're here and that you're hearing about it. And I feel I feel honored to be able to talk about it because it's so hard for me to do this on a daily basis. But, there's a lot of juice here, even if you don't ever practice Tantra, just hearing about it, I think is good. And then, you know, maybe at some point, even little bits and pieces of it, you know, sometimes you can find some help through hearing about it. So we'll get more into the deity yoga aspect of it next week, you know, where we talk about how it's the resultant vehicle. So we'll talk about that, and we'll do some deity yoga. So that'll be good. So thank you.